This is Jay Sekulow from England. The Supreme Court of the United States again affirms Obamacare.
Live from Washington, D.C., Jay Sekulow Live.
This is the word we're getting from multiple sources from the U.S. Supreme Court. We're going to get to our correspondent, Shannon Bream, in a moment, but it appears at the moment, in a 6-3 ruling with the opinion written by the Chief Justice John Roberts, that the subsidies for Obamacare have been upheld, which means the 6 million Americans in the states where it was contested will be able to continue getting their subsidies. That would be a significant victory for Obamacare, the legislation, the Affordable Care Act, and the administration.
He talks about them upholding the law in 2012. He says they went through all kinds of gymnastics to do that. He says today represents another time. He says it has rewritten the law, the court, to make tax credits available everywhere. We should start calling this law SCOTUS care, not Obamacare. He's clearly very ticked, but he only got two other justices to join him. So a 6-3 opinion that upholds the law based on the fact that the justices, six of them, found that those four words weren't plain meaning enough.
And now, Chief Counsel for the American Center for Law and Justice, Jay Sekulow.
Welcome to broadcast, everyone. As you can tell, I'm on a cell phone in the United Kingdom, actually at Oxford, at our Oxford Center for the Study of Law and Public Policy. We're starting a series of meetings dealing with other issues, not the Supreme Court, actually dealing with Christian persecution in the Middle East. But as everybody knows, the Supreme Court of the United States issued a decision in the case involving the Obamacare subsidies. You'll remember the decision focused on whether, in fact, subsidies would be available when insurance was purchased from a federal exchange rather than a state exchange. Now, the law was very clear. The law said state exchanges. And this could have crippled Obamacare and pretty much eliminated it. In a 6-3 decision authored by, again, the Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts, the court held that despite the language, that in fact it would be reinterpreted, in essence, to apply these subsidies to federal exchanges, even though the law said only the state exchanges. Let me read you my statement that we've issued. I said this decision is disappointing and troubling. Unfortunately, the majority of the court failed to apply the law as written. The court instead rewrote the law, something they do not have the constitutional power to do. It's troubling that the high court backed the Obama administration's overreach in its ongoing effort to rewrite or suspend portions of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, in violation of the separation of powers. The court clearly overstepped its authority. That is reflected by Justice Scalia in this line from his dissent, where he said we should start calling this law SCOTUS care, because the Supreme Court keeps saving the law, even though it is unconstitutional in Justice Scalia's view and in our view. Unfortunately, that was not the majority. Jordan, you've just done a series of interviews on Fox. What's the reaction you're hearing?
Listen, I think that it's not so much shock at the court doing this. They've already gone through these gymnastics to save this law before, twice in the last case a few years ago with the individual mandate, also with the Medicaid expansion, saying that even though that was unconstitutional, it shouldn't bring the whole law down, and then, of course, interpreting the individual mandate to be a tax. Now taking what seems very clear to everyone, just sentences that established by the state, that again has been going through these judicial gymnastics that the court, through Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Kennedy, and the liberal justices, not so surprising there, has really done everything possible to save this law for President Obama and the Obama administration.
Scalia, in his dissent, said words no longer have meaning, and I think that is absolutely true. We're going to get into a full analysis of this opinion. When we come back from the break, we'll be joined by Dan Bennett, our Director of Government Affairs and Associate Counsel for the ACLJ, Joseph Williams. We'll be back in just a moment. Folks, let me encourage you to do something. We're in the last week here of the month of June. We are ahead of last year. We want to continue momentum. I want to urge you to support the work of the ACLJ today, whether it's in the United States or around the globe. If you go to aclj.org, you can make an online contribution. You'll be getting some email alerts from me on our cases. I encourage you to respond. Support the work of the ACLJ. aclj.org or 1-877-989-2255. That's aclj.org or 877-989-2255. Make your gift to the ACLJ. And don't forget our book, Undemocratic. Precisely what we talked about in the book is precisely what the Supreme Court did today. You need to know how to fix it. You can get the book Undemocratic wherever books are sold.
Americans' freedom under attack by the biggest and most dangerous branch of government, the federal bureaucracy. In his new book, Undemocratic, How Unelected, Unaccountable Bureaucrats Are Stealing Your Liberty and Freedom, ACLJ Chief Counsel Jay Sekulow sounds the alarm. It's a powerful look at what's become the fourth branch of government. It's not in the Constitution, but the federal bureaucracy has become an out-of-control, unelected monstrosity that robs Americans of their rights through endless rules and regulations. In Undemocratic, Jay Sekulow, a New York Times bestselling author, provides a plan to fight back and explains why personal freedoms don't have to become a thing of the past. This must-read is available now in bookstores nationwide. You can order your copy online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Apple iBooks. Learn more at undemocraticbook.com. It's time to put an end to the systematic abuse of the federal government. When it was first released last fall, Rise of ISIS skyrocketed to the top, becoming a number one New York Times bestseller. ACLJ Chief Counsel Jay Sekulow and his Law of War team revealed the brutality of ISIS, the Islamic State, putting a much-needed spotlight on this real and present danger. Now this best-selling book, Rise of ISIS, has been revised and updated with critical new insight and new analysis. Find out how ISIS continues to expand, to dominate, to unleash unspeakable violence against Christians and others, and find out what needs to be done to stop them. A revised and updated edition of Rise of ISIS, A Threat We Can't Ignore, is available now at bookstores nationwide. Or you can order a copy online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Apple iBooks. Rise of ISIS, available now.
Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. Let me give you a synopsis quickly here of the decision. It's a 6-3 decision. The court found that even though the language of the statute says in the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, that these subsidies would only apply to exchanges established by the state, the Supreme Court of the United States in a 6-3 decision made that a completely ignored the plain language, acknowledging that it was a strong argument. In fact, they said petitioners' arguments about the plain meaning of Section 36B are strong. Let me go to Joseph Williams, who made a quick analysis of the case. Joseph, let's go through that section first of what the court said, because basically the Supreme Court acknowledges that the argument we made, that the language is clear, was correct, but they ignored it. Let's put that in context.
The majority, led by Chief Justice John Roberts, states that the petitioners' arguments about the plain meaning are very strong. They go on to say, in this instance, the context and structure of the act compel us to depart from what would otherwise be the most natural reading of the pertinent statutory phrase. They are admitting, basically, yeah, that the strongest argument is the one that they are arguing against.
Yeah, so the irony here, folks, is the court itself acknowledges that the language is clear. And this would have gutted Obamacare. So the court went out of its way once again to salvage this disastrous health care law. But they acknowledge that the argument about the phrase state exchanges is very strong, because the statute does say state exchanges. And, Jordan, that's where the court really engaged in an overreach here, and in my view, an unconstitutional overreach, and Justice Scalia and two other justices agree with us.
Well, they took, I mean, most of the majority opinion is going through the gymnastics to the bending and the swaying to get to this point where you can take something that's so clear and say, but we, if you look at the overall content, they say that the health care law, the Affordable Care Act, was, quote, inartfully written in portions of it, and the inartful drafting, as they said, but that Congress passed the Affordable Care Act to improve health care insurance markets, not destroy them, so they're not they're going to depart from the plain meaning, though they've said that's strong. And I think for most people out there, it's not just strong, it's absolutely clear. This again underscores to me that it's something we talk about a lot. The courts are, especially the Supreme Court, it's the last resort for these kind of challenges. But the political challenges continue. And so while these battles, and again, this was one that a lot of people didn't expect would even get all the way to the Supreme Court, when it did, you realize it was a second kind kind of bite at the apple, if you will, on taking down the Affordable Care Act through the courts. But it just doesn't look like through the Justice Roberts and the current makeup of the court that's going to happen. It's very clear they'll do everything possible to save this law.
Let me go to Stan Benin, our Director of Governmental Affairs, because, Stan, I know that there are members of Congress that are still, and I respect that they're doing this, calling for the getting rid of this Obama statute and replace it with a health care plan that would make sense. This one does not. It's been disastrous, actually. What is the sense in Capitol Hill right now? I guess in one sense this decision was a little bit of a surprise because the administration had been preparing to lose the case because the language was so clear. But again, as Jordan said, and as Justice Scalia said, the court goes through kind of a word gymnastics to get to the point. What's the reaction on the Hill?
Well, I think that's right, and I think Jordan's right on the ramifications for the health care law, Jay. But, you know, I think one of the big reactions you're going to see out of the Hill today, and what I'm already starting to hear, is just how troubling of a blow this ruling is to their legislative powers. I mean, you know, you're going to hear a lot of people talk about how some on the Hill are relieved that they don't now have to step in and fix the, quote, problem that would have resulted from a different ruling. But listen, that's a political issue of courage, and that's not the relevant point here. The relevant point here is that the legislative branch has lost the ability to write laws and to write legislation that will be interpreted as it is written. Jay, if the phrase established by the states is ambiguous, then everything that Congress writes is ambiguous, and they are going to have to be very aware of that ruling, moving forward. I think it deals a real blow to their legislative powers, and I think that's what you're going to hear from them today.
Well, that's what we should be hearing. I want Joseph to read the second paragraph, or at least the beginning of it, where he quotes the majority. Chief Justice Robert quotes Marbury versus Madison. I want everybody to listen to this sentence. Joseph, read it for everybody, and then I want to make a comment on this because they quote it, and then they do exactly the opposite.
Yes, Chief Justice Roberts writes in his conclusion to the majority opinion, "In a democracy, the power to make the law rests with those chosen by the people. Our role is more confined, to say what the law is."
Yeah, but of course, the court did the exact opposite. The court is correct in saying that in a democracy, and especially in a constitutional republic, the power to make the law rests with those chosen by the people, the legislative branch. They did. The legislative branch may have been inartful, may have been poorly worded, but that is the wording. State exchanges. The court then says our role is more confined to say what the law is. What the court cannot do, and what they've done here, is rewrite the law. Justice Scalia, in his dissent, says this: words no longer have meaning if an exchange that is not established by a state is established by the state. In other words, the court is the Chief Justice takes the position that he's just simply conforming with the legislative intent. The Justice Scalia, I think, correctly says, wait a minute, words do have meaning here, and the words were clear. Now, the question is going to be, and this is the political ramifications of this, what does this mean politically? Was this, I mean, people are asking, was this a political decision? And I have to say, Jordan, that the court seems to be, as Justice Scalia says so artfully, this really is SCOTUS care, because it is the Supreme Court that keeps salvaging this disastrous law.
That's absolutely right. I mean, you've got a situation here where this is actually the third time, because if you look at the first Affordable Care Act case, and there were two separate issues there where the court took one, the individual mandate, and said, well, it's a tax, even though they didn't want to call it that, so we're going to save it that way. Then they went to the Medicaid expansion and say, oh, that's unconstitutional, but we don't think it impacts enough of the rest of the law, so the whole law doesn't fall. That was the first two times. Fast forward a few years later, and now they've taken what is even a clear portion of the law, where, you know, the established by the states. Shouldn't that mean established by the states and not established by any government, wherever that government is, or the federal government? Because we know the difference in the way our country is set up with states, federal government, local governments, all of that. It seemed very clear that the court, and that's why Justice Scalia in his dissent calls it SCOTUS care, because they've saved this law again.
It's interestingly that Justice Scalia also in his dissent says this: more importantly, the court forgets that ours is a government of laws and not of men. That means we are governed by the terms of our laws, not by the unenacted will of our lawmakers. And that goes to the fact that the court, Joseph, acknowledged, and you've gone through the opinion now, the court acknowledged that the Affordable Care Act was very sloppily written. And Chief Justice Roberts and majority of the court said it's very poorly written. They don't even hide that fact.
The majority repeatedly points that out, and Justice Scalia in his conclusion refers to it as, similar to what Jordan has said, the somersaults of statutory interpretation the court is performing today. And the cases, this one, the 2012 Obamacare decision, Scalia says, will publish forever the discouraging truth that the Supreme Court of the United States favors some laws over others and is prepared to do whatever it takes to uphold and assist its favorites. And there is no other explanation for what's happening.
Yeah, well, they've certainly done that. I mean, there's no doubt that this is, again, gymnastics, somersaults, whatever you want to call it. The court is going out of its way to, and this is supposed to be a conservative court, folks. So this tells you we are in a fight for our constitutional republic. I mean, understand, we are in a fight for our constitutional republic. When a court, nine justices in a court, six of them say, a law doesn't say what the law actually says. And that's what this comes down to at the end of the day. We could read 21 pages, as Justice Scalia said, trying to justify this. But the law was very clear. And the law said state exchanges. That's where you get it. And the architect of the law, remember Mr. Gruber, Dr. Gruber, who said, if you don't have a state exchange, you're going to be penalized? Well, evidently, the architect of the law didn't know what the law was either. We'll come back from the break. And I want to get into the legislative, what's left legislatively that can be done here, because actually this fight is not over. It's, again, the Supreme Court's decision. We think 6-3 was wrong. We think the Scalia dissent is right. But nevertheless, we deal with the hand we've been dealt, and this is the hand we've been dealt. So now we've got to look at legislative responses. And does this issue impact the political process? You bet it does. In fact, I would say this is a political decision. Hey, folks, as I said at the beginning of the broadcast, we are in the last week of the month of June. And we're trying to get ahead of our budget for compared to last year. And we're on our way to doing that, and you're making a huge difference. So first, for those of you that have been supporting the ACLJ this month, let me thank you. For those of you that haven't, go to aclj.org or call us at 1-877-989-2255 and pledge an amount of support for the ACLJ. Of course, it's tax deductible. But more important than that, you're helping us fight cases here in the United States and literally around the globe. And you know, as you can tell, I'm in England today dealing with Christian persecution issues at the University of Oxford. We've got our team in our media center, Ben, and our offices in Washington. And the fact of the matter is, your help makes a huge difference. So aclj.org or 1-877-989-2255. You'll be getting some emails from me in the next few days as well. I encourage you to respond to those emails with your support. Contributions to the ACLJ make a huge difference. And don't forget our book, Undemocratic, available wherever books are sold. And that's deals exactly with these kind of cases. Back with more in a moment.
Americans' freedom under attack by the biggest and most dangerous branch of government, the federal bureaucracy. In his new book, Undemocratic, How Unelected, Unaccountable Bureaucrats Are Stealing Your Liberty and Freedom, ACLJ Chief Counsel Jay Sekulow sounds the alarm. It's a powerful look at what's become the fourth branch of government. It's not in the Constitution, but the federal bureaucracy has become an out-of-control, unelected monstrosity that robs Americans of their rights through endless rules and regulations. In Undemocratic, Jay Sekulow, a New York Times bestselling author, provides a plan to fight back and explains why personal freedoms don't have to become a thing of the past. This must-read is available now in bookstores nationwide. You can order your copy online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Apple iBooks. Learn more at undemocraticbook.com. It's time to put an end to the systematic abuse of the federal government. When it was first released last fall, Rise of ISIS skyrocketed to the top, becoming a number one New York Times bestseller. ACLJ Chief Counsel Jay Sekulow and his Law of War team revealed the brutality of ISIS, the Islamic State, putting a much-needed spotlight on this real and present danger. Now this best-selling book, Rise of ISIS, has been revised and updated with critical new insight and new analysis. Find out how ISIS continues to expand, to dominate, to unleash unspeakable violence against Christians and others, and find out what needs to be done to stop them. A revised and updated edition of Rise of ISIS, A Threat We Can't Ignore, is available now at bookstores nationwide. Or you can order a copy online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Apple iBooks. Rise of ISIS, available now.
Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone, if you're just joining us. Supreme Court decision, 6-3, again, affirming Obamacare. This time the challenge was the law said that there would be subsidies available for people that participated in Obamacare on the state exchanges. Most states did not set up an exchange, and the federal government had its own exchange, what's called federal exchanges. And the IRS, again, through the Obama administration, made the administrative determination that a federal exchange meant a state exchange, even though a state exchange is a state exchange. As Justice Scalia says, the court basically changed the wording and redrafted the law. Nevertheless, that leaves the law in place. And the first question you have to ask yourself is, now with two Supreme Court opinions affirming Obamacare, what is the next fix on this? How do you deal with this? And it's going to play out in the presidential elections coming up in 2016. What's the sense, Stan, on Capitol Hill right now for the desire to get rid of this law and replace it with something that will work?
Well, I think there's still a strong desire for that, Jay, but I think you just touched on what this means politically. I mean, politically, this makes Obamacare and the replacement and or repeal of it a frontline issue for the presidential campaign. Those candidates that want to be the next president of the United States now have to realize that the court challenges to at least the structure of Obamacare, they're over at this point. Now they have to come up with their ideas for what they would do to replace this. And of course, Congress needs to be a part of this. We need to see leaders in Congress now be willing to offer comprehensive, not just ideas, Jay, but comprehensive plans that would structurally replace Obamacare. Yes, we know they're not going to get enacted with this president. That is why everyone who wants to be president of the United States needs to come to the table now and say, this is what we would do instead. The Supreme Court has upheld Obamacare. If you elect me, I will do this instead. It becomes now, Jay, one of the very frontline issues of the 2016 campaign.
I want, you're absolutely right. I believe that too. I want Joseph to read, there's a section of the opinion that we have in what we call the powerful conclusion of Justice Scalia's dissent. And it's the last paragraph of the memo that we put together. But I want Joseph to read for everybody. I want you to hear this, where Justice Scalia talks about having transformed two major parts of the law, referring to the other two opinions. Let's read that up until where he goes to the SCOTUS hairline, because I want everybody to listen to what he actually said here.
Justice Scalia said, having transformed two major parts of the law, the court today has turned its attention to a third. The act that Congress passed makes tax credits available only on an exchange established by the state. This court, however, concludes that this limitation would prevent the rest of the act from working as well as hoped. So it rewrites the law to make tax credits available everywhere. We should start calling this law SCOTUS Care.
And the reason he's saying call it SCOTUS Care is the Supreme Court continued, now for the third time, to rewrite the law. Everybody needs to understand that. The court is rewriting the law. And Joseph, it's interesting, in the memo you put together, in the majority opinion, they acknowledge that they are having to rewrite the law here. They say they shouldn't do it. They say that the argument that it's the statute is clear, is strong. Again, I'll read the first part. Petitioner's argument about the plain meaning of Section 36B are strong. But then they go on to say that when they read it as a whole and they get the legislative intent, they basically give themselves the authority to rewrite the statute.
They say that the context and structure of the act compel them to depart from what would otherwise be the most natural reading of the pertinent statutory phrase. They go on to talk about.
I want you to say that. I want you to say that again. I want everybody to hear. This is not our analysis of it, folks. This is the language of the majority opinion. I want Joseph to read that again in this instance line, because this tells you a lot about where this court is.
Chief Justice Roberts, writing for the majority, the six justices, says, in this instance, the context and structure of the act compel us to depart from what would otherwise be the most natural reading of the pertinent statutory phrase.
I mean, think about that for a moment. I mean, this is the irony of ironies. The language is clear. The court acknowledges it's a strong argument. The plain meaning of the section is clear. The court acknowledges in a democracy the power to make the law rest with the chosen, those representatives chosen by the people. Our role, the Supreme Court's role, more confined to say what the law is, Marbury versus Madison, an 1803 decision. Then they say it's easier in some cases than others, but in every case we must respect the role of the legislature. And then, Joseph, they basically ignored what the legislature wrote and rewrote the law.
Justice Scalia points out that Article 1 of the Constitution makes very clear that the legislative powers belong to Congress. The court is not responsible for making laws and mending laws, that Congress would have any number of options before it to do what is constitutional if the court did what was constitutional and said the plain reading of the text is very clear. Even the majority realizes this. Speaker Boehner has just come out with a statement saying Obamacare is fundamentally broken, increasing health care costs for millions of Americans. We still have a responsibility to repeal it and reform it.
So let me ask this to Than. With that statement coming out from the speaker, what is your sense that what happens legislatively here, Than? What do you think?
I think there's a significant lesson for Congress to take, and I hope Speaker Boehner is paying attention to this. I think the lesson is that it should teach Congress that it can't depend on the Supreme Court to fix the problems that it allows to happen. I mean, that's what happened here. The Congress passed a law that was sloppily written, and yet on this point it was clear, and the Supreme Court did not bail them out. I think that Speaker Boehner and Leader McConnell and those in Congress who believe that the court got this wrong should come out forcefully and should draft a comprehensive replacement. And then ask the presidential candidates who want to be the next president of the United States whether or not they would sign that piece of legislation into law. And then, Jay, that sets up a situation where the people of America who are going to the polls can decide what do they want. Do they want this structure of Obamacare that the Supreme Court just saved, or do they want the specific replacement that Congress has put forward and that the next president of the United States could sign?
And then Justice Scalia in his dissent ends with this two lines, and the cases will publish forever the discouraging truth that the Supreme Court of the United States favors some laws over others and is prepared to do whatever it takes to uphold and assist its favorites. He then wrote, I dissent. And so do we, and I believe so do a large number of the American people. We're going to give you more analysis on this at ACLJ.org. That's ACLJ.org. We will keep you posted. Also, we're going to have more discussions about what this means as far as a whole system of government coming up next. We're going to talk more about our book, Undemocratic. You're going to want to stay tuned for that. There is an opinion day tomorrow, so we may well be coming to you. Again, I may be coming to you from Oxford University as we look at opinions coming out tomorrow. The last day of the term is going to be Monday, so the last opinions will come out Monday, of course. The major opinion that a lot of people are waiting for is the marriage case. That will come out either tomorrow or Monday. Most people are expecting it to come out Monday. Folks, if you want to support the work of the ACLJ, let me encourage you to do this at ACLJ.org by making a donation to the work of the ACLJ. And those of you that get our email lists, are on our email list and get our email alerts, you're going to be getting some alerts from me in the next few days. We're trying to set a goal. I want to see if we can increase our budget for the month of June by 20%. We're on path to do that, but we need your help. Go to ACLJ.org to make an online donation, of course, tax deductible, or 1-877-989-2255. It's 1-877-989-2255 or ACLJ.org. Don't forget our book, Undemocratic, available in bookstores everywhere. And boy, is it relevant today. Again, the book's called Undemocratic. And like our pages on Facebook. I've got a page. The ACLJ has a page. And follow us on Twitter as well. We've got more coming up. Be back in a moment.
Americans of their rights through endless rules and regulations. In Undemocratic, Jay Sekulow, a New York Times bestselling author, provides a plan to fight back and explains why personal freedoms don't have to become a thing of the past. This must-read is available now in bookstores nationwide. You can order your copy online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Apple iBooks. Learn more at undemocraticbook.com. It's time to put an end to the systematic abuse of the federal government.
I'm talking about freedom. I'm talking about Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. I'm reading excerpts from my book, Undemocratic. I talk about the problems facing our country, the attacks on freedom and liberty by an unelected, unaccountable fourth branch of government, and that's the bureaucrats. But I also provide solutions in the book on how we can take our government back. But the purpose of the book is to educate you, our friends that listen to this broadcast, and to share it with your friends as well. So the book is Undemocratic. Here's where we need your help. We need you to order the book and get your friends to do the same thing. So the book's called Undemocratic. You can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can get it online, or you can get the ebook version or the hard copy or wherever books are sold. Again, the book is called Undemocratic, How Unelected, Unaccountable Bureaucrats Are Stealing Our Liberty and Freedom. And it's available in bookstores everywhere, certainly on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Apple. Ebooks available again, or the hard copy. I encourage you to get it today. Now let's go back to the book.
My family name wasn't originally Sekulow. That's the Americanized version of Sokolov or Sokolov, a Russian name that was difficult to translate into English. When my grandfather landed at Ellis Island, the intake officer heard his name and wrote Sekulow, and we've been Sekulow ever since. My grandfather fled Russia during the time of the Russian persecution of Jews as the fires of repression and religious intolerance raged. The seeds of the Russian Revolution had been planted, which bloomed into the Soviet Union, a nation that continued the campaign of persecution. Europe has long been hostile to Jews, and sadly, much of that hostility continues to this day. But Russia ramped up the persecution to an unprecedented level. The story of the Russian Revolution is a story of death and war, with the Red Army cutting a swath of destruction across Russia, enemies of the Soviet Union slaughtered in great numbers, and the larger world, exhausted by the devastation of World War I and struggling in the face of a horrific flu pandemic that killed millions, too distracted to prevent the disaster. Those who could flee did. Fortunately, my grandfather's family had fled Russia in 1914, just 3 years before the revolution took place. So my grandfather wound up on Ellis Island, one young 14-year-old boy among millions who saw the Statue of Liberty with its welcome to those who were tired, poor, and yearning to breathe free. And like those millions, he immediately set to work becoming an American, to building a life in the land of the free. He ran a fruit stand in Brooklyn, New York. His life wasn't easy, but he never stopped working, he never stopped striving, and he passed down his values and his love of his adopted country to his children and grandchildren. Two generations later, one of those grandchildren of the fruit peddler was arguing cases at the Supreme Court of the United States. I think of my grandfather every time I'm in the high court and I hear the words, "Mr. Sekulow, we will now hear from you." The grandson of Shmulek Sekulow, arguing before the most powerful court in the world. You can call it many things, but I call it American exceptionalism. America is an exceptional country, and my family's journey is a symbol of that exceptionalism. My family overcame the odds, moving from fruit peddling to the Supreme Court in just two generations. But we overcame the odds in part because we were in America, a land of unprecedented opportunity and liberty. And of course, my family's not alone. Look far down virtually any American family tree, and you'll find an immigrant family who came here against long odds and fought to build a better life. And these families succeeded in building a free land that is the most powerful, most prosperous, and most secure in the history of the earth. That is exceptional. Sadly, however, when we speak today of American exceptionalism, many on the left will roll their eyes. They'll recount stories of America's past sins, or they'll do what President Barack Obama did and dismiss American exceptionalism by saying that, of course, we think we're exceptional, but so do the citizens of every country. To these critics, American exceptionalism is nothing but misguided parochial affection, no different than the pride sports fans feel in their local team. But this is wrong. American exceptionalism isn't merely a garden variety case of national pride, nor is it a blind love of country. No one thinks America is sinless. After all, the phrase is American exceptionalism, not American perfection. If American exceptionalism isn't American perfectionism, then what is it? Was Thomas Paine, the great American patriot, right when he declared, "The cause of America is in a great measure the cause of all mankind"? I believe he was.
Again, the book title is Undemocratic. It is available wherever books are sold, but certainly on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Apple iBooks. And by the way, we've got both an e-reader version, which is for your Kindle or your Nook or your Apple iReader, as well as the hardback. So if you go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or wherever you buy your books, ask for Undemocratic, How Unelected, Unaccountable Bureaucrats Are Stealing Our Liberties and Freedom. Jay Sekulow, that's me. I'm the author. We want to make sure you get the book again, Undemocratic, wherever books are sold.
Americans' freedom under attack by the biggest and most dangerous branch of government, the federal bureaucracy. In his new book, Undemocratic, How Unelected Unaccountable Bureaucrats Are Stealing Your Liberty and Freedom, ACLJ Chief Counsel Jay Sekulow sounds the alarm. It's a powerful look at what's become the fourth branch of government. It's not in the Constitution, but the federal bureaucracy has become an out-of-control, unelected monstrosity that robs Americans of their rights through endless rules and regulations. In Undemocratic, Jay Sekulow, a New York Times bestselling author, provides a plan to fight back and explains why personal freedoms don't have to become a thing of the past. This must-read is available now in bookstores nationwide. You can order your copy online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Apple iBooks. Learn more at undemocraticbook.com. It's time to put an end to the systematic abuse of the federal government. When it was first released last fall, Rise of ISIS skyrocketed to the top, becoming a number one New York Times bestseller. ACLJ Chief Counsel Jay Sekulow and his Law of War team revealed the brutality of ISIS, the Islamic State, putting a much-needed spotlight on this real and present danger. Now this best-selling book, Rise of ISIS, has been revised and updated with critical new insight and new analysis. Find out how ISIS continues to expand, to dominate, to unleash unspeakable violence against Christians and others, and find out what needs to be done to stop them. A revised and updated edition of Rise of ISIS, A Threat We Can't Ignore, is available now at bookstores nationwide. Or you can order a copy online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Apple iBooks. Rise of ISIS, available now.
Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. I'm reading excerpts from my book, Undemocratic. The purpose of the book is to educate you, our friends that listen to this broadcast, and to share it with your friends as well. So the book is Undemocratic. You can get it online, or you can get the ebook version or the hard copy or wherever books are sold. Again, the book is called Undemocratic, How Unelected, Unaccountable Bureaucrats Are Stealing Our Liberty and Freedom. And it's available in bookstores everywhere, certainly on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Apple. Ebooks available again or the hard copy. I encourage you to get it today. Now let's go back to the book.
Think about my grandfather. He was certainly not an American when his family fled Russia, where they faced certain persecution and possible death. But he was not without hope because of America. In every war or disturbance, there are refugees, and there are nations that take in refugees. But my grandfather was no refugee. He was fleeing, yes, but he was fleeing with his family to a fresh start, a place where he could reinvent himself and, in a sense, rewrite his family history. The course of my family's destiny for generations was impacted by the decision of my great-grandparents. They came to a place where they had a true hope for a new life. They came to America. I have long believed that America's exceptional nature is a function of the symbiotic relationship between the nation's people and the nation's laws. I think of America as a nation with a great people matched with a great system of government. Note well that I did not say great government. Sometimes we've been led by poor governments, but always the system, our constitutional system, has allowed us to persevere and ultimately prosper. It may be apocryphal, but I love the story of Benjamin Franklin's admonition following the end of the Constitutional Convention in 1787. As the tale goes, Dr. Franklin emerged from Philadelphia's Independence Hall, and a woman asked him, "Well, doctor, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" His response, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." The simple Webster's definition of a republic is a government in which supreme power resides in a body of citizens entitled to vote and is exercised by elected officers and representatives responsible to them and governing according to law. But our government is not just a republic, but a constitutional republic. The law that governs our nation is defined and limited by a constitution, and in our case, the constitution is designed primarily to guarantee the liberty of our citizens and limit the power of government over our lives. In other words, Benjamin Franklin's short statement spoke volumes. We formed a government for a free people, for a people committed to liberty, and to keep that government, the people had to be dedicated to preserving it. For most of our history, Americans have not only been committed to keeping our republic, but to improving it, spreading freedom and liberty to those who weren't permitted to enjoy it fully in our nation's founding. And a republic has since allowed a free people to flourish, and the free people have continually pushed the government to protect their liberty and their primacy in our constitutional system. By preserving in the Bill of Rights our rights to free speech, to religious liberty, and our right to petition the government for redress of grievances, we put in motion the mechanism for immense positive change. It's through the exercise of those rights that we were able to move past slavery and Jim Crow, grant women the right to vote, and preserve a host of American liberties through war and peace. The system of checks and balances prevented our president from becoming a monarch, the Supreme Court from becoming an oligarchy of unelected judges, or Congress from becoming, at worst, something like France's out-of-control national convention where mob rule brought ruin to a revolution. It's a system I've dedicated my life to preserving and defending. As I said before, I began that defense as a public servant within the system, working for the Department of Treasury, Office of Chief Counsel for the Internal Revenue Service. Yes, I work for the same agency that is now best known in the conservative movement for launching a targeting campaign that has persecuted thousands of President Obama's political opponents. But when I worked there, it was a different time. I started in 1979 during the tail end of the Carter presidency and left early in the Reagan administration. I remember those days well. We did our job, we enforced the tax code, and political discussions or considerations were simply not part of our job. Even though the IRS was unpopular, when has a taxing agency ever been popular? I was proud of the work we did, honored to work with outstanding lawyers on both sides of the political aisle, and I felt that I'd done at least some small part to work honestly and efficiently to support a constitutional structure that had done so much for me and my family. After gaining that valuable experience, I left the IRS and launched out on my own, eventually doing more than I ever imagined I would to defend our Constitution, to defend that system that helps make our nation truly the hope of the world. In Supreme Court case after Supreme Court case, I defended individual liberty. I was honored, along with key partners, to found a law firm, the American Center for Law and Justice, that has by now filed hundreds of lawsuits and written thousands of briefs to defend our Constitution. Through victories large and small, we've been able to expand liberty in key areas, including in schools, in the workplace, and in our nation's public spaces. But now that system that we've defended so vigorously is under threat. In fact, our constitutional democracy is at stake. I do not choose my words lightly. The threats emerging now in 2015 dwarf anything that I've seen in my long legal career, and the threats, while multifaceted in their legal character, tend to emanate not from our elected officials, but instead from the emergent, vast additional branch of government, the fourth branch, the bureaucracy. A bureaucracy that is increasingly circumventing the founders' established checks and balances and imposes its will on the American people against their expressed wishes. Have we prevented a monarchy, an oligarchy, and mob rule only to succumb to the dangers of a vast bureaucracy rendered invulnerable by its very complexity and size? How could this possibly happen? How a bill becomes a law, and a law, and a law, and a law. When my sons were very young, Saturday morning featured not just normal kids' shows, but also a series of extended educational cartoons set to music. Called Schoolhouse Rock, they featured catchy tunes and described the rules of grammar, narrated events in American history, and provided basic civics lessons. My favorite was a short 3-minute episode called, simply enough, How a Bill Becomes a Law. I can still remember the lyrics. It began, "I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill." And I can still see the singing bill, a rolled up piece of paper with legs, sitting there on the steps of the Capitol, not far from where our ACLJ offices are today. The singing bill made a national network comeback last year in a Saturday Night Live parody of President Obama's expansive immigration executive order, a parody that made the same critique I make in this book, that the executive branch is simply making up its own laws. The original song took kids through all the basic steps. First, the bill is written and presented to a committee in the House of Representatives or the Senate. If it survives in committee with a majority vote of committee members, then it goes to the full House or Senate. If it passes with a majority vote in both houses, it goes to the president for signature. If the president signs the bill, it's a law, and it's headed for the statute books. If the president vetoes the bill, it goes back to the House and Senate, where it can still become law if the House and Senate override the veto with a 2/3 majority in each house. Simple enough, even simpler when you tell the story in rhyme and song. But the cartoon left out an important step, a final step that protects liberty from a Congress or president who disregards the Constitution. Most laws can be easily challenged in court by citizens who believe the laws violate their rights. After all, in a constitutional republic, the supreme law of the land isn't represented by acts of Congress, but instead by the text of the Constitution. Laws that conflict with the Constitution are, or should be, null and void. So for many laws, the journey from idea to reality is long and hard, involving committee hearings, votes in Congress, presidential evaluations, and finally judicial review. By the time a law is actually enforced, especially a law of true consequence, it's been debated, voted on, and challenged. The process has worked the way it's supposed to work. But if we wish to expand the power of government and believe the answer to society's ills is found far more in government action than in the workings of private marketplace or private charity, a process like that is simply too slow and inefficient to solve all the nation's problems. So enter the rulemaking process. It sounds benign. What could be wrong with making rules? Plenty. The bureaucracy creates thousands upon thousands of new laws, laws never voted on by Congress, rarely reviewed by judges, and enforced often by armed agents of the very agency that wrote the rule. That's not separation of power, it's consolidation, apart from democracy. Here's how the process works. Federal statutes explicitly and sometimes implicitly not only create permanent federal agencies, agencies like the IRS, EPA, DOJ, NLRB, FCC, and many, many others, but also empower them to craft rules or regulations allegedly designed to help the agency enforce the law. Often, Congress fails to do its job and writes laws with deliberate gaps in meaning, directing or permitting federal agencies to write rules to fill those gaps and clarify the meaning of the statute. Notable recent examples include Obamacare, where the law was so poorly drafted that it couldn't be understood without the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, the IRS, and other agencies writing new rules and regulations. We must be concerned that the IRS is now involved in our health care decisions. The IRS has enforcement authority through IRS agents to mandate compliance. So now the IRS and HHS are supervising up to 20% of our nation's economy.
I've been reading excerpts from our book, Undemocratic. It is available in bookstores everywhere. Look, the fact of the matter is freedom is under attack like never before. And the truth of the matter is the fourth branch of government, which doesn't exist in the Constitution, by the way, are the unelected bureaucrats. And then, unfortunately, they have become the most powerful branch of government. So I'd ask you and your friends to go buy a copy of Undemocratic, How Unelected, Unaccountable Bureaucrats Are Stealing Our Liberties and Freedom, and How We Can Take It Back. And I believe we can take it back if we work together on this. Again, the book title is Undemocratic. It is available wherever books are sold, but certainly on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Apple iBooks. And by the way, we've got both an e-reader version, which is for your Kindle or your Nook or your Apple iReader, as well as the hardback. So if you go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or wherever you buy your books, ask for Undemocratic, How Unelected, Unaccountable Bureaucrats Are Stealing Our Liberties and Freedom. Jay Sekulow, that's me. I'm the author. We want to make sure you get the book again, Undemocratic, wherever books are sold.
Americans' freedom under attack by the biggest and most dangerous branch of government, the federal bureaucracy. In his new book, Undemocratic, How Unelected, Unaccountable Bureaucrats Are Stealing Your Liberty and Freedom, ACLJ Chief Counsel Jay Sekulow sounds the alarm. It's a powerful look at what's become the fourth branch of government. It's not in the Constitution, but the federal bureaucracy has become an out-of-control, unelected monstrosity that robs Americans of their rights through endless rules and regulations. In Undemocratic, Jay Sekulow, a New York Times bestselling author, provides a plan to fight back and explains why personal freedoms don't have to become a thing of the past. This must-read is available now in bookstores nationwide. You can order your copy online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Apple iBooks. Learn more at undemocraticbook.com. It's time to put an end to the systematic abuse of the federal government. When it was first released last fall, Rise of ISIS skyrocketed to the top, becoming a number one New York Times bestseller. ACLJ Chief Counsel Jay Sekulow and his Law of War team revealed the brutality of ISIS, the Islamic State, putting a much-needed spotlight on this real and present danger. Now this best-selling book, Rise of ISIS, has been revised and updated with critical new insight and new analysis. Find out how ISIS continues to expand, to dominate, to unleash unspeakable violence against Christians and others, and find out what needs to be done to stop them. A revised and updated edition of Rise of ISIS, A Threat We Can't Ignore, is available now at bookstores nationwide. Or you can order a copy online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Apple iBooks. Rise of ISIS, available now.
Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. I'm reading excerpts from my book, Undemocratic. I talk about the problems facing our country, the attacks on freedom and liberty by an unelected, unaccountable fourth branch of government, and that's the bureaucrats. But I also provide solutions in the book on how we can take our government back. But the purpose of the book is to educate you, our friends that listen to this broadcast, and to share it with your friends as well. So the book is Undemocratic. Here's where we need your help. We need you to order the book and get your friends to do the same thing. So the book's called Undemocratic. You can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can get it online, or you can get the ebook version or the hard copy or wherever books are sold. Again, the book is called Undemocratic, How Unelected, Unaccountable Bureaucrats Are Stealing Our Liberty and Freedom. And it's available in bookstores everywhere, certainly on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Apple. Ebooks available again, or the hard copy. I encourage you to get it today. Now let's go back to the book.
Another example is a so-called Dodd-Frank legislation, written with the intent of tightening banking regulation so that crashes like the one that brought our economy to its knees in late 2008 and early 2009 won't ever happen again. Dodd-Frank was passed and signed into law by President Obama in July 2010. Yet by the summer of 2014, the banking industry still wasn't sure what the law meant. The law was intentionally incomplete, and instead of fully describing its provisions, Congress set 398 rulemaking deadlines so that unelected bureaucrats could fill in the gaps. In other words, it empowered federal agencies to make 398 separate regulations with the full force of law. By the summer of 2014, 4 full years after the law was passed, 208 rules had been finalized, but a whopping total of 96 hadn't even been proposed. Pass the law to find out what's in it, indeed. By comparison with federal statutes, federal regulations are thoroughly undemocratic. Whereas a bill can become law only by vote of a popularly elected Congress, signed by the elected president, a proposed rule becomes a regulation through a process that vests virtually all the authority in the rulemaking agency and leaves the public with the ability to provide our opinion only. Once an agency determines a rule is necessary, it publishes the proposed rule in a publication called the Federal Register, an enormously complex publication, thousands of pages that even few lawyers can truly understand or navigate. The proposed rule is then subject to something called a notice and comment period, where you, members of the public, have an opportunity to support or critique the proposed rule. You do not vote, nor do you vote on the people who are drafting or proposing the rule. After receiving public comments, the agency will then once again take to the scintillating pages of the Federal Register to publish the rule, provide the specific date it will take effect, and describe how it responded to public comments. That's it. That's the process. And while the process is simple for bureaucrats, allowing them to write more than 13,000 new rules in the first years of President Obama's terms in office, it can be virtually impossible for the public to grasp. The language alone is almost impossible to follow, with the Federal Register written not in plain English, but in a cryptic government speak that requires a particular expertise to understand. To get a sense of the bureaucratic language employed in the Register, here's the summary of a recent proposed rule called Avocados Grown in South Florida and Imported Avocados, Clarification of the Avocado Grade Requirements. Quote, this proposed rule invites comments on changes to the minimum grade requirements currently prescribed under the Florida Avocado Marketing Order and a technical correction to the avocado import regulation. The order regulates the handling of avocados grown in South Florida and is administered locally by the Avocado Administrative Committee. For South Florida-grown avocados, this proposed rule would align the regulations with current industry practice. It would remove language permitting the commingling of avocados with dissimilar characteristics in containers for shipment within the production area. All avocado shipments within the production area would need to meet the provisions of a U.S. No. 2 grade as provided in the United States standards for grades of Florida avocados. For imported avocados, this rule would also make a technical correction to the avocado import regulation to clarify that the minimum grade requirements for imported avocado remains unchanged at a U.S. No. 2. Clear enough? Got that? Good. Jobs are at stake. As undemocratic as this process is, it's far more democratic than a process often used to regulate the environment, an area where millions of jobs, our national economy, and our public health are at stake. As described in John Fund and Hans von Spakovsky's excellent book, Obama's Enforcer, the environmental section of the Department of Justice has pioneered a process called Sue and Settle, where it will collude with a radical environmentalist organization to circumvent Congress and the Federal Register altogether. This scandal will be described in greater detail later in the book, but here's the basic outline. The environmentalist group will sue, demanding a court order that would essentially act as a new environmental regulation on an industry.
We got our Jay Sekulow band together to put together a song for the launch of our brand new book, Undemocratic. The song's title is exactly the same, Undemocratic. Here it is. Undemocratic. It is available wherever books are sold, but certainly on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Apple iBooks. And by the way, we've got both an e-reader version, which is for your Kindle or your Nook or your Apple iReader, as well as the hardback. So if you go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or wherever you buy your books, ask for Undemocratic, How Unelected, Unaccountable Bureaucrats Are Stealing Our Liberties and Freedom. Jay Sekulow, that's me. I'm the author. We want to make sure you get the book again, Undemocratic, wherever books are sold. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time.
Robs Americans of their rights through endless rules and regulations. In Undemocratic, Jay Sekulow, a New York Times bestselling author, provides a plan to fight back and explains why personal freedoms don't have to become a thing of the past. This must-read is available now in bookstores nationwide. You can order your copy online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Apple iBooks. Learn more at undemocraticbook.com. It's time to put an end to the systematic abuse of the federal government.